Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews, and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture, and urban design. Hello and welcome to the Green Room. Today we're looking at retain, refit, and recycle. We are looking at the importance of a circular economy in landscape architecture, urban design and construction. So society didn't always live in the linear fashion that we do today, which is take, make and waste. In fact, Furnitubes was founded on the principles of repurpose and reuse. Our founder was a marine engineer who reused steel tubes from post-war marine shipyards to produce products for the new NHS, schools and the London City Council. Today I'm joined by Alex Lowenhoff, a landscape architect at Outer Space, which is a practice that has pledged to push for circular design practices on all their projects. Alex has written a great article on the circular economy for the Outer Space blog and is here today to talk about the circular economy. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming. So, Alex, what is a circular economy and specifically how does it apply to the built environment?
A circular economy is a form of economic development, decouples growth from resource use. So it keeps materials at their highest value for as long as possible to limit the amount of waste going to landfill and takes pressure off our natural resources. So it's in complete contrast to how we currently do things, which is in a linear fashion. So it's often referred to as the take, make and waste model, which is great for growing our GDP, but hugely detrimental to the environment. For example, 90% of biodiversity loss is caused by how we extract and process natural resources. So more specifically to the built environment, we're wasting approximately 15 to 20% of materials delivered to a building site, which equates to one house worth of material for every 5 houses built. And globally across the world, we're built the equivalent of one New York City every month. So if you think about all the materials, embodied carbon that goes into that, we're consuming and emitting that every month. So that's the argument for the circular economy, specifically in the built environment.
The built environment contributes a large amount to the waste industry. I mean, 50% of London's waste comes from the built environment. Obviously, we need to address this. As you say, we're just scratching the surface and it feels like there's a massive shift that needs to happen, not just, you know, a new policy or, you know, whole industries need to change the way that they work. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about circular design principles? How will these principles help or be applied specifically in the construction industry? You know, Alistair Bayford has been on this podcast and has talked about, you know, reusing, going to sites and not necessarily starting from scratch and throwing away everything that's on the site to replace it, mm-hmm. and how certain materials can be reused. Mm-hmm. How would you look at the design principles? Can you talk them through us?
You already mentioned like over 50% of waste comes from the built environment sector. Clearly, we have a huge part to play. So as designers who like specify materials, design spaces, what can we do about that? The GLA has recently published a circular economy designer's guide, which coupled the release of the London Plan, which has now taken the circular economy into policy. Within that guide, they split the circular economy approach into four themes for a designer. The first theme is minimizing resource use and avoiding waste. You mentioned Alistair talked about that recently on the other episode. So how a designer can do this, the most important thing is to appraise what's already there, what's already on site. So what we're doing out of space at the moment is material audits. So just like we would analyze design lines or circulation of a site or the microclimate, we'll do a material audit at the beginning of a project, which appraises what material is already on site, what assets are available for potential retention and reclamation. So for a recent project, as an example, we enhanced an office campus and the paving appeared to be in a bit of a sorry state, but when you look at it closely, all it needed was a bit of maintenance, a bit of tender, loving care.
Good clean.
Yeah, just a good clean. We jet washed it down, weeded between the cracks, and it honestly looks brand new. So you think of all the carbon savings on that.
Yeah.
And the cost for the client was massively reduced.
So really, it's a win for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just frustrating that it's not being done more often. Because it feels like the go-to at the moment is you approach a project and you start afresh and you rip it up and move all those materials off-site and you start again, which is like hugely frustrating. That's why we're wasting so much materials in the industry.
If you go with the approach that it's a blank canvas every time, first of all, you've got to make the blank canvas, so you've got to get everything off.
Yeah.
And then you're doubling up because you're wasting and then you're remaking something that could already have been there in the first place.
Yeah. I know at the moment, like, a lot of developments, they'll use a lot of the demo waste as like hardcore for the subgrade.
Right.
But that sort of goes against the circular economy principle of keeping the material at the highest value.
With least processing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the more you break it down, the more you process it and degrade it, the more embodied carbon you're wasting, because all the energy and the processing that's gone into making that product in the first place is wasted, essentially. And then, like, another simple thing you can do is just design to the dimensions of your building materials. So if you think of a pavement, if you're using 400 mil flags, make it 1600 mil wide. So it's like really simple things like that to avoid offcuts.
Don't make it 1400 wide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you are, use 200 mil. So I think that essentially covers the first theme. It was really positive to hear Alistair talk about the Triton Square project, which Malin worked on, where they lifted the granite pavers, stored them, and then brought them back and reused them. So that's exactly what that theme's all about. It's really minimizing the resource use and avoiding wastage.
I think it comes down to it's that audit phase of either the designers with the contractors, actually, and this is something Alistair talked about, coming together at an earlier phase to actually do an audit of what's already there and decide what can be reused or retained and cleaned, and thinking about the most efficient use of the existing materials. And that feels like that's a part of the engagement that maybe needs to become more common at the beginning of a project.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think contractors are engaged early enough at the moment. They'll come in at tender stage and do the pricing and cost it up. But if they're involved at concept stage, then it's much easier to apply circular economy. So move on to the next theme of the designer's guide is design for longevity. Simply build landscapes that last. Which again, you know, landscape architects should be doing anyway. Too often you see furniture pieces or brittle paving that's been spec'd, which might come down to value engineering. Again, I'll talk about Alistair's podcast again, but he was talking about bespoke furniture pieces that are faced with hardwood, but then the structure is made from softwood.
Right.
Which, of course, saved money at the time. But then a few years later, you're going to have to go and do a bit of maintenance or completely replace the module. So it's all things like this. It's like investing more early on to build landscapes to last so that they have a 50-year lifetime instead of a 10-year, 5-year lifetime.
So we can design for longevity. So we want to look at schemes that really approach schemes to last. I mean, all the elements should be invested in at the beginning so they have longevity. Mm-hmm. What about schemes that maybe change their purpose throughout their lifetime? So an office block becomes a residential block, with the landscaping outside needing to adapt. How can that be addressed?
From a design point of view, if you can design in some flexibility with furniture pieces, pavement, planters, it's much more likely that those materials will be able to be used for the new scheme later down the line. Mm-hmm. So if you think about building with Lego, when you're a kid, you had like a box of, you know, the colourful bricks, and you could build a house one day and a bridge the next day.
Yep.
It's all the same elements and pieces. So we got a project in the office at the moment. We've been tasked to detail these bespoke granite planters. So they're different forms made out of granite blocks. So what we've done is made at least 80% of those planters out of blocks that are all the same size.
Right.
So it's easier to lift those and repurpose them in the future, as opposed to going bespoke and shaping elements uniquely. So that's one of the issues with concrete as well. It's a great building product and it's sort of a designer's dream, but once you cast a piece of concrete to make this beautiful shape, later down the line, if you want to adapt and change its use, really the only thing you can do is smash it up and crush it into subbase, because you can't cut up.
Yeah. The way we would see it is standard modules that can be reused in various configurations, just like Lego blocks.
Yeah, exactly.
So you want elements within your landscape that can be put together in one formation, and then a few years later, those same elements can be reused in a different formation to serve a different purpose. So what happens at the end of life, at the end of a project's life? How can we best ensure that we're not just thinking about done our best at the beginning, we've looked at reusing materials, we've looked at the longevity of a project, we've looked at making it as adaptable and flexible as possible, so being really efficient and careful with our use of resources. What about the end, or when a product or a scheme has reached the end of its life, what can we do?
So the last thing to think about is exactly that, designing for disassembly. So allowing that scheme to be salvaged and the materials mined in the future. Duncan Baker Brown wrote a great book, The Reuse Atlas, and in it he talks about mining the Anthropocene, making the argument that all of the materials we already need are above ground. So going up slightly off track, but you'll now find more gold in a ton of iPhones than you would in a ton of the best gold ore in the world. Yet our attitude is still looking outwards and ripping up environments and landscapes and ecosystems to get to the materials we need.
So always going straight for the source of the raw material rather than looking for where we can find it in a processed form somewhere else.
Yeah, a lot of the materials we already need are in circulation.
Yeah.
And that's what the circular economy is all about. So going back to the original question of designing for disassembly, what we can do is basically avoid design landscapes with adhesives or chemically bonding materials.
Uh-huh.
It'll make it much easier when it comes to the end of life, disassemble that product or furniture piece or pavement, and then use those materials for another purpose. And something that happened during lockdown was there was a circular series run by the Architects Climate Action Network. They were proposing and theorizing how can we truly embrace the circular economy in the built environment. And one of the concepts was to add Ariba Stage 8 to the design programs.
Right.
So that would be to truly embrace the circular economy, and it would be titled Ariba Stage 8 for Demolition and Salvage. So really designs in the circular economy into the project programs.
Thank you for walking us through those phases. And it's really interesting that with the Architects Climate Action Network, looking at how we embrace more of the principles of the circular economy into our life cycle of a project. How has the circular economy approach changed outer spaces approach as a practice? You detailed some of the things that you're looking at in your article, but how have you changed your approach to projects?
So I think firstly, one of the biggest things is we're now doing material audits for each of our projects. So right from the start, we're appraising what's already on site and what we can reuse, refit, or repurpose for our new designs. It's a really simple step, but making a point of it as part of the design process ensures you're designing in circularity.
So you're setting your intent from the very beginning.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then from that, we're following the circular design hierarchy, which is detailed in the London plan. It's a circular diagram, which has the layers moving out from the inside out. So that the first one in the middle is the first principle is retention, and it moves out to refit, refurbish, reclaim. And then the last one's recycle. The idea being that the further out you go, the diminishing returns on the efficiency of that process. So I'm not saying recycling is bad. It's a very good thing. But to do it, you have to go through the process of dismantling that product and use all that energy to break it back down to its basic elements.
And then process it to build it back up again.
Exactly.
Whereas if you could just reuse it, you've saved all of that energy. Yeah.
Exactly. Another thing we're doing is we're continuing with our human nature approach, which is all about creating comfort with nature. So prioritizing soft over hard spaces.
Mm-hmm.
This like avoids overspecking materials. So do you really need to pave that public square completely?
Right.
And just turn it into another 50 shades of grey courtyard?
Yeah,
it's prioritizing soft spaces over hard, which is not really much of a change from what we were doing before, but it all complements the circular approach.
But also from a maintenance perspective, right? It makes more sense.
Yeah, you might get the argument that putting in soft landscaping requires more maintenance, but it's inherently cheaper, it's better for the environment, and you get all the amenity benefits as well. And of course, great for biodiversity. And then lastly, we put together a comprehensive CPD program. We've been inviting in reuse suppliers to talk about what they're doing and how we can collaborate in the future. So Ashwell's Reclaimed Timber are a great example. They sum up the circular economy in their approach.
Yeah.
It's a company that salvages hardwoods across the UK. So it's normally tropical hardwood that's already been taken over to the UK, and they repurpose it into another use. So for us as landscape architects, we can look at working with them to create play or furniture pieces. Also, we run internal workshops to brainstorm and go through what are the barriers in practice and then how we can break those barriers down.
So what are the barriers? What would be an example of those?
Some of the barriers that we've come up with, value engineering. Mm. So what if you've gone to that time and effort to reuse a product or repurpose it, but when it comes to it, it turns out it's cheaper just to buy new,
yeah.
Which unfortunately at the moment, that's probably often the case.
Yeah.
Another one is reliably sourcing reuse materials. So if we're working on a big scheme, how can we guarantee that we're going to have the salvaged paving or enough of it to fulfill the demands of the new scheme, which again, very hard to guarantee at this stage because I don't think reliable supplies out there for reuse materials yet.
Right.
Or it's the impression we get anyway.
In terms of there are enough of them or they're established enough?
It's first finding them.
So Ashwell's being a great example of a reliable, yeah, known source of reclaimed tropical timber,
yeah,
tropical hardwood timber.
Exactly. But if we could have, I don't know, like a reuse marketplace for designers,
right,
for example, that we could just go to and then find out what's available on the market,
yep,
and then reserve it for the project to fit in with the timeline. It'd be much easier for us to design, yeah, with circularity.
Yeah, because it's easy to find new products, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
But where is that marketplace for existing products that are available to be reused? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So even if you've done a materials audit or an audit of the existing site and you can see what's there, if you need to augment that, where else can you find those augmented pieces?
There is a company, Globe Chain, who specialise in reuse materials, but I know they've worked on architectural projects that I'm not sure if they fully embrace landscape projects yet.
Right.
Or equally, as I said earlier, I don't think the reliable supply is there. So if you go on their website, you know, it's not necessarily, say if I'm looking for paving, or maybe if there's suddenly like 1,000 bricks available online, they'll either quickly go.
No, but it doesn't feel like there's a solid enough marketplace. It's bitty, basically.
That's what I'm, yeah,
that's
what
I mean. It's yeah, short term rather than constant supply. It's very much in the moment, if that product's available, you need to get it, otherwise it's gone. But if you're, yeah, speccing a scheme that's 2 years out,
yeah,
it's quite difficult to look for what's going to be available in 2 years.
And it's scaling up as well. So the, yeah, size of the development, as I said, makes it a lot harder if it is a huge referable scheme compared to, I don't know, a one unit scheme. Another barrier is who takes on the risk of repurposing, mm-hmm, yeah, things on site. So we're working on a scheme at the moment in Tower Hamlets, where they have really fun play swing and trampoline. But unfortunately, the new block that's going to essentially stitch up the urban fabric, so create this courtyard, is going to go over the top of those. As part of our material audit, we identified them. And then we found out the residents actually really enjoyed using that, like all the kids particularly. Mm. So our aspiration is to relocate those and retain them. But with that comes the risk of damaging them, or, yeah, you might compromise how safe they are.
Yep. And who takes on that risk?
Who takes on that risk?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it a contractor?
Mm.
Or is it us as designers?
Yeah.
I don't have the answer yet.
No, but it's true. I think when you're reusing materials and you've decided to move them, you're changing not their purpose, but where they've come from, which does involve risk. In terms of how we get to circularity, we've talked about the REBA Stage 8 for demolition or deconstruction. What else is being introduced at the moment or is going to be introduced to help us get to a more circular economy within the construction industry?
So I think I said earlier recently that circular economy has been adopted into policy. So it's now within the London plan for referable schemes to submit a circular economy statement as part of their planning application. So bearing in mind that is just for referable schemes, which is essentially large development. which has been a very positive thing. So Outerspace is working on like big estate regeneration projects. And as part of the design process, we're now having circular economy workshops with the whole design team. And that's all come from having to submit that circular economy statement. Policy is starting to push us in the right direction, but I think there's the argument it needs to be more stringent. So why is it just referable schemes? Why can't it be all schemes? And then once we get that top-down steer, it'll be a lot easier for the whole industry to move as one towards a circular economy, because you have people out there who want to do good things and do good work and adopt this circular approach, but there might just be one practice like Outspace or one supplier like Furnitubes or one contractor. But if you get top-down steer that forces everyone down this route,
yeah,
then obviously it's going to be a lot more of a smoother process,
yeah,
and we'll end up doing a lot more good things. So it'll be a much more positive outcome.
Yeah, you can't have the odd company here and there doing it. It needs to be a collective, and policy is what you need to basically push the collective, push the industry as a whole.
Yeah.
It needs to be driven from policy.
Mm-hmm.
I love the quote that you give in your article and love to reference it as a goal or a vision of what we should be aiming for, which is in 2050, we live well within the planet's ecological limits. Our prosperity and healthy environment stem from an innovative circular economy where nothing is wasted and where natural resources are managed sustainably and biodiversity is protected, valued and restored in ways that enhance our society's resilience. Our low carbon growth has long been decoupled from resource use, setting the pace for safe and sustainable global society. And that came from the Environment Action Programme to 2020. And it's a really, really lovely vision. So I thought what we could possibly sort of end on is some great examples of where you've seen this already put into practice, so that we've got the vision, but what does it look like at the moment?
When we were looking around and trying to look for inspiration to see what's been done out there, we found wind turbines have actually got a great use for being playgrounds.
Right.
So there's a company now called Rewind, and their whole ethos is to repurpose wind turbine blades, because at the moment it's a huge issue because they can't be recycled,
right,
because of the material that they're made out of. So a wind turbine, I think it has a design life of 20 to 25 years. So suddenly there's a lot of wind turbines that are being thrown to landfill.
Yes. Yeah.
And in the landscape industry, they're being used to build bridges, build playgrounds. So that the one we've seen is in Holland. Just looks incredible. Like, imagine being a kid and running down the shaft of the wind turbine,
right,
as a tunnel, or sliding down the blades.
Amazing.
Or like other simple innovations have been using the blades as cycle shelters. People might argue or complain that if we adopt this circular economy approach, it might hinder our creative boundaries. But I think Rewind have proved that's not the case.
There's nothing like a really good design brief to be more creative, right? So
exactly,
use this turbine blade.
Yeah.
What can you do with it?
Yeah. Go make a playground.
Yes. Yeah. I think you get more creative than not having restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
For me, this has been really, really interesting. And I can see that. So for me, the main takeaway is really at the beginning of a scheme is that time that's put into looking at what's already on a scheme, the materials audit. So what can be retained and reused to avoid waste? So rather than recycling or taking away completely, what can be just left and reused? Making sure we design for longevity, so our products, materials are invested in at the beginning and last a good lifetime. And that we're thinking about what the scheme might be used for over its lifetime. So making it as adaptable and flexible and modular as possible. And then thinking about the end of life. So how do we, at the beginning of a scheme, think about already how it could be deconstructed or disassembled so that all of the elements can be really reused as well as possible. So you and Outer Space have invested and really thought a lot about the circular economy, and it's great to hear the examples in your practice of what you're doing. What other resources are there that you would recommend to people listening to this podcast if they want to find out more about the circular economy?
There's three things that I would say. The first one is to go on the Ellen MacArthur Foundation website, and they have really brilliant learning hubs, which really simply put how designers can change the way they do things to become circular in their practice. And that's for every sector, agriculture, fashion, but obviously more importantly for today's built environment. So I would say go on their website and have a look. Really won't take long to go through their learning hubs. Second point is familiarize yourself with the Design for a Circular Economy guidance document from the GLA, because that gives a more detailed account of what we can do in the construction industry. And my last point would be to go onto YouTube and check out the ACAN circular series. So they're each an hour long. It's one talk for every REBA stage, and they break down exactly what we can be doing to adopt the circular economy into our program for the built environment.
Alex, we ask everyone who comes on three questions at the end of our podcast. Mm-hmm. So firstly, what made you want to become a landscape architect?
So I initially did a degree in environmental science, and I graduated and got a job as an environmental consultant, which involved a lot of surveys in and around London. So often I do two or three sites a day, and I'd either walk or cycle between them. And I think it was at that point that I sort of became conscious to public space and the role that it plays in our cities and how it improves our quality of life.
Absolutely.
But it also sort of the pin dropped on someone's actually designing these spaces, like someone's job. Whereas before I probably hadn't really thought about it, which got me like looking into it, reading about the profession and finding out about it. And luckily I had a friend at Sheffield University.
Yeah.
He was already on the course. So shout out to Grace Ruddick. And she basically took me through the course, showed me around, and I sort of took the leap, spent all my savings.
Yeah. That's thanks to Grace.
Yeah, cheers, Grace.
I think it's really important that you understood the value of the public space and the impact as a landscape architect that you would have on that.
Yeah. And it's not just becoming aware of good public space. I was getting frustrated with, you know, the car-dominated city.
Yep.
Although I was seeing positive changes. And obviously there's been a lot of good work recently in making the city more cyclable and walkable. Something that is a bit frustrating is I wasn't conscious of the profession when it mattered.
Yes.
So I don't know, if I feel like practitioners probably have a bit of responsibility to go into schools.
Raise the profile.
Make young adults aware of how great a profession it is, and it's something you could consider. And, you know, it's a very accessible career. Like, you don't have to be a nuclear physicist to become a landscape architect. There's so many different strands to it. So if you know a bit about science and art and geography, geology, etc. So for me, it was all of those coming together into one profession. Should have done it when I was 16.
Jane Finley, actually, from the Landscape Institute, summed it up really well. I mean, she's also, in her podcast, talked about how do we raise the profile of the profession. But she also talked about why she went into the profession, was it brings together so many interesting elements. So you can be really creative, you can be technical, scientific, there's a design element. Mm-hmm. So the biological, the geographical kind of element to it as well. You can either push it in one way or another, but it also isn't just one particular focus. Mm-hmm. Brings all the elements together.
Yeah, best of both, isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah. So what is the one thing landscape architects and the landscape architecture profession can do right now to help combat the climate disaster?
I think design for a circular economy.
Yeah.
What we've just been talking about. But I'd say also be a nuisance.
Yeah.
So I think it's too easy just to go along with the status quo and accept certain decisions in a development and not pipe up. But if landscape architects don't defend the planet and biodiversity, etc., who will?
So challenge the client.
Yeah, challenge the client, challenge the design team, move away from those 50 shades of grey piazzas. And it's a really good quote from Greta Thunberg, which I will say, it's stop looking for hope and start creating it. And I think that's exactly what we should be doing. But also just prioritising soft over hard spaces. Mm-hmm. That's a really easy win in terms of embodied carbon, but also creating great spaces that people want to spend time in.
And be outside.
Yeah, exactly. So be a nuisance and listen to Greta and design with nature.
Great things to live by. So lastly, Alex, if you could put a bench in one spot in the world, where would it be and why?
Yeah, it's really our question, but I think I'd probably put it outside my block of flats, because at the moment it's just a car park. Because the other day there was an elderly woman like shuffling down the street towards the high street, and she needed a rest, and all she could do was just lean against the wall. And I think we've taken away the opportunity to sit and pause,
yeah,
in our streets, because they actually make up such a huge portion of public space in the city, yet we're not allowing people to stop and spend time in them.
We're focused on A to B,
yeah,
and not the pauses in between.
Yeah, you know, a seat is more than a seat or more than a bench, getting a bit philosophical, but, you know, it's a chance for people to come together and have that social contact. Yeah, and it symbolises an inclusive environment. If you have a bench outside my block of flats.
I love it. Might be able to arrange that.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Alex. Thanks for coming in today and talking about an important topic that needs much more airtime. So thank you for coming
brilliant.
In.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, thank you for giving it a platform. It's been good fun.